Nuclear promises, nuclear lies. How far back do they go? For an industry that was birthed in wartime secrecy during the Manhattan Project, after the horror that met the bombing of Japan, it needed to establish a rationale for continuing to exist. So how about making up something called Atoms for Peace and the promise of an unlimited supply of electricity generated by nuclear energy, a supply that was promised to be too cheap to meter? Nuclear reactors as the Santa Claus of energy. Huzzah! But really, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch, especially when it comes to nuclear. So here we are, decades later, and you listen closely when a respected leader and member of some of the most prestigious organizations that oppose the nuclear enterprise tells you,
"I would suggest that that very statement of too cheap to meter was a bald-faced lie from the get-go. And it's my argument that what the government has done has given us all these sales pitches. It's too cheap to meter. It's clean. It can solve climate change. None of those arguments are at all true. They're just meant to sound good to the public and to gain public acceptance and support for the nuclear enterprise."
And that's exactly what they've been accomplishing. Public acceptance of the nuclear enterprise. And that's what we're fighting against, though not as effectively as we might. So when you hear Alfred Meyer, a longtime member and executive of Physicians for Social Responsibility and many other nuclear groups, explain why our talking points aren't working, and then he comes up with suggestions of how we need to be framing our arguments against nukes in a way that links the energy and weapons arguments, you begin to recognize how you and I and everyone have been manipulated into wasting time and energy making great arguments against the wrong targets and allowing the continuation of our time in that awful, devastating seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, an amazingly illuminating interview with Alfred Meyer, a longtime member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, who has worked to found, lead, and support numerous other organizations that oppose nuclear. His insights are solid, grounded, and as a result of this interview, I've already shifted many of my talking points as regards the connections between nuclear energy and nuclear war. This is a real eye-opener. So stay tuned. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than Japan is willing to hear from the world about its crime against nature scheme to dump Fukushima's radioactive water into the Pacific. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, January 24, 2023, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. This morning, January 24th, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists announced the latest setting for the Doomsday Clock, which symbolically measures how close humanity is to destroying itself. After 2 years at 100 seconds to midnight, which is the closest it had ever been measured, this year it was moved ahead 10 seconds, and now the world is, in their estimation, 90 seconds away from annihilation. One of the speakers at the unveiling live stream, Mary Robinson, who is chair of the elders and former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, said, "The doomsday clock is sounding an alarm for the whole of humanity. We are on the brink of a precipice. But our leaders are not acting at sufficient speed or scale to secure a peaceful and livable planet. From cutting carbon emissions to strengthening arms control treaties and investing in pandemic preparedness, we know what needs to be done. The science is clear, but the political will is lacking. This must change in 2023 if we are to avert catastrophe." Here in the U.S., 9 military officers who had worked decades ago at a nuclear missile base in Montana have been diagnosed with blood cancer, and there are indications the disease may be linked to their service. This according to military briefing slides obtained by the Associated Press. One of the officers has died. All of the officers, known as missileers, were assigned as long as 25 years ago to the Malmstrom Air Force Base. And the 9 officers were all diagnosed with non-Hodgkin lymphoma, a blood cancer that uses the body's infection-fighting lymph system to spread. The median age for adult non-Hodgkin lymphoma is 67, while the former missileers were all in their 30s or 40s. And why are so few talking about the power grid amid extreme winter storms? We will link to an article with that as the headline on nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 605. In Japan and around the world, opposition is heating up to that country's determination that it will, yes it will, yes it promises it will, release radioactive water from Fukushima Daiichi into the Pacific Ocean this year. Pushback is becoming fiercer by the day, which is reflected in much of the media coverage of this issue. Japanese fishermen in the Fukushima area are particularly angry about this. One young fisherman is quoted as saying, "The government will force the release of the treated water even if I scream." And the chairman of the Fukushima Prefectural Fisheries Federation has appealed to the government and Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, saying, "We cannot consent to the discharge into the ocean. We will remain resolutely opposed to this." Last September, a joint petition of 42,000 Japanese people opposed to the discharge plan was submitted to TEPCO and Japan's Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry, but no response has been heard. The Pacific Island Forum, a regional bloc of 17 island nations, are arguing that the release of the water could have major impact on fishing grounds that island economies rely on and where up to half of the world's tuna is sourced. China has spoken out against this proposed release of 1.25 million tons of nuclear radioactive wastewater into the Pacific. As Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin said at a recent press conference, "It is regrettable that the concerns of all parties have yet to be given due attention or be addressed by Japan," adding that Japan has failed to provide scientific and credible explanations concerning the legitimacy of its plan, the accuracy of data on the nuclear contaminated water, the effectiveness of the treatment system, and the uncertainties about the environmental impact. And green activists in South Korea are coming together, issuing a statement that reads in part, "The Pacific Ocean is not the Sea of Japan, but the Sea of everybody. Pollutants will flow to neighboring countries in a situation that a lot of radioactive materials have already been released and contaminated, the marine ecosystem." It went on to state, "A sizable amount of the contaminated water, such as tritium, is difficult to purify no matter how much purification is performed. It is very irresponsible to release it as it is." And Greenpeace International's petition to halt the plan garnered close to 200,000 signatures. Additional opposition to Japan's plan have come from Taiwan and the United Nations. We will have links up to several articles dealing with this, including a wonderful roundup article from Counterpunch by Robert Hunziker entitled "Fukushima's Toxic Dumping Flashpoint." And then there is this quote from the nation of Vanuatu's most famous politician, Motuarelavoa Hilda Lini, who said, "We must remind Japan that if the radioactive nuclear wastewater is safe, just dump it in Tokyo, test it in Paris, and stored in Washington. but keep our Pacific nuclear-free. And that's the same issue being faced in Massachusetts, where Holtec, which is decommissioning the Pilgrim nuclear power plant, is threatening, if not promising, to discharge radioactive water, tritium-contaminated water, from the spent fuel pools into Cape Cod Bay. It's the same issue with a different ocean, and sets of fishermen from both locations deserve to be talking to each other. More international news. Russian hardliner Dmitry Medvedev, a Russian hardliner, is warning the world that nuclear weapons are not off the table. The former Russian president and current deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council said in a social media post on Thursday that Russia's defeat in the war with Ukraine could trigger a nuclear conflict. He said, "The defeat of a nuclear power in a conventional war may trigger a nuclear war. Nuclear powers have never lost major conflicts in which their fate depends." South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol said on January 11th that if North Korea's nuclear threat continues to grow, his country will press the United States to redeploy nuclear weapons in the South, or else it may build a nuclear arsenal of its own. And for more on where we may be going with nuclear weapons, here's
Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. None that's out of the week.
Hey, are you ready to party down with the people who are planning to kill us all? Well then, fasten your seatbelts and get your booty down to Arlington, Virginia for the 15th Anniversary Nuclear Deterrence Summit. February 13 through 15, join with an enormous roster of war criminals for what is being billed as, quote, the premier event for nuclear deterrence decision makers to network, get high-level strategic updates from high-profile and expert speakers who are moving the industry forward, and connect with one another to create business for 2023 and beyond. Yep. The Nukesters are throwing themselves a bash to celebrate their ability to destroy the world and create business in the process. How capitalistic of them. Meanwhile, on the list of attendees, standing out like a lone soldier holding off the hordes, is the Los Alamos Study Group. Yes, that's right, the group that has been working since its founding in 1989 for nuclear disarmament, environmental protection, social justice, and economic sustainability, mutually reinforcing aims that map directly onto the converging crises we face, regionally, nationally, and internationally. How the heck did that happen? Well, we'll have the answer on next week's show, number 606, when we interview Greg Mello, who will be our lone warrior at the gates. That is going to be quite the interview. But for now, because dancing on the collective grave of the planet, partying, networking, and planning those technologies capable of flattening us are all so contraindicated by life itself, 15th Annual Nuclear Deterrence Summit, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of the week.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, follow the money. That's what the nuclear industry does, never letting up with their propaganda, talking points, op-eds, talk show bookers, and other tactics to brainwash our politicians, reporters, and the public into giving them whatever they want, which is money, money, and, oh yes, more money. And let's face it, they already have plenty with which to fund their PR hacks and their agenda. It's a business model with a terrific ROI. Return on investment. Because whatever millions the Nukesters spend on their public relations propaganda, they stand to get billions of dollars back from bailouts, subsidies, tax breaks, and it all comes from the hapless taxpayers who provide the money whether we want to or not. And that is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. For more than 11 years, Nuclear Hot Seat has empowered listeners every week with a one-hour hit of honest nuclear information. We provide in-depth interviews with genuine experts, a roundup of international news, numbnuts, bad puns, the Nuclear Hot Seat hot story, occasional bursts of musical theater, Where else can you find all this in a weekly counterbalance to nuclear industry lies? But they operate with virtually unlimited financial resources, whereas this show operates on a bake sale budget. And that budget is entirely dependent upon you, the listeners, to keep us going. That's why, if you value what we do, the time to support us with a donation is right now. And we make it easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and help us with a donation of any size. You can also set up a recurring donation for any amount as little as $5. And your donations are tax deductible because we're a 501c3. So please, do what you can now. And know that however much you can help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Sometimes when I reach out for an interview, it's with someone whose work I've not known, but I've caught something that they said or wrote and gotten the impulse to learn more. Often I'm rewarded with a different perspective of information that opens my eyes and shifts my focus to something deeper, richer, and more compelling, which is what happened as a result of this week's guest. I was on a Zoom meeting with Joseph Mangano of Radiation and Public Health when during a Q&A I first heard today's guest, Alfred Meyer. He packed so much information and insight into just 2 minutes that I knew I had to get him on the show. Then I read his October 2022 article in The Progressive, It's All About the Bomb, Why Civilian Nuclear Power is Merely a Cover for Producing More Nuclear Weapons. As a piece of writing, it's a knockout. Alfred Meyer is a longtime member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, PSR, and has served variously as Executive Director of PSR Wisconsin, Board Member of PSR National, and President of PSR New York. He also co-authored a PSR IPPNW, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, critique of the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Nuclear Radiation report that purportedly reported on the health effects of the radioactive releases from the damaged Fukushima Daiichi nuclear reactors in Japan. Alfred has also founded, co-founded, and or served as an executive for half a dozen other major organizations dedicated to nuclear issues relating to Fukushima, Chernobyl, Ukraine, and the connection between proposed fusion weapons with nuclear reactor infrastructure. His insights into languaging and framing our arguments against nuclear are seismic, and you deserve to not only listen, but take notes, take his suggestions to heart, and use them wherever you can. I spoke with Alfred Meyer on December 23rd, 2022. Alfred Meyer, thanks so much for joining us here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's my pleasure.
Give people a sense of your background and what has been your involvement with nuclear groups and issues.
I've been a longtime member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I've fulfilled several different roles with the organization. For a number of years, I was the executive director of the Wisconsin chapter. I then moved to Washington, D.C., where I became where I joined the national board of PSR. I served on that board for 12 years. Now I'm living in New York City, and so I'm involved with the New York City chapter.
You recently published an article in The Progressive called It's All About the Bomb, with the subtitle, Why Civilian Nuclear Power is Merely a Cover for Producing More Nuclear Weapons. And I'd like to go through some of the points that you made here on a step-by-step basis, because it was a real eye-opener for me.
Well, I'm glad it did make you think differently about this, because I fear that we've been hoodwinked by a fairly successful public relations campaign over many decades.
I would call it a propaganda campaign, but we'll get to that.
Yeah.
Let's start at the beginning, when the United Nations seems to have played a central, if indecisive, role in international positioning on atomic and nuclear issues. What were their early efforts starting in 1945 to control this technology?
I'm not able to answer that in any detail. I know that in a general sense that there were various groups who wanted to either abolish or control nuclear activities, and that the world was absolutely horrified by the United States' use of nuclear bombs in World War II. And I note in my article that when we firebombed Tokyo, burning 100,000 people and dislocating over a million people, that didn't seem to be a huge problem. But when we used the two atomic weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that occasioned huge outcry against this new kind of weapon and a new kind of horror. There was a big pushback against the whole nuclear enterprise.
It seems that one of the stumbling blocks, which you mention in this article, is the fact that the United Nations gave special status to countries that were recognized as possessing nuclear weapons. We're talking about the Security Council, all five members of which are nuclear countries. They all have ultimate veto power, and that made it impossible, really, for the United Nations to take any strong stand against nukes. Would that be accurate?
Yes, I don't actually know what year the Security Council made the five nuclear powers permanent members, but you're absolutely right that the Security Council, they have veto power over what the Security Council does. I'm very pleased to report that the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, TPNW, one of the genius parts of that is that the organizers went to the General Assembly, where there was not the veto power by the weapons-holding countries. And there was vast concurrence that this is an unacceptable threat to life on Earth. And that's why that treaty has been passed, and many countries are ratifying it. And so that has been a very wonderful counterbalance. I'm very sorry to say that I do feel that the United Nations is, generally speaking, pro-nuclear. Well, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which does do some very fine and important work, but if you go look at their mission statement, it is stated in just so many words that their mission is to promote nuclear technology. Promote nuclear technology. And I think that's a very unfortunate thing. And the United States was instrumental in founding the IAEA at the UN. And that its initial leaders were from the U.S., which ensured that the U.S. interests were safeguarded.
Let's take this in somewhat chronological order. Starting back in 1945 and going through to the early 50s, how did nuclear weapons, which of course had an automatic pushback by people around the world, by governments around the world, how did nuclear weapons evolve into this acceptance and promotion of nuclear power reactors, nuclear energy?
At the end of World War II, the notion was promoted that we won that war because we used atomic weapons, that atomic weapons are the magic super weapon. It's what we feared Germany would get and therefore be able to dominate the world. But we got them, and we feel militarily that this was our ultimate trump card, our strongest suit. And so even though the public opinion in the world was very, very much against nuclear weapons, the military was very, very much for nuclear weapons. And I allude to the problem that President Eisenhower had when he came into office in 1953, because he had his military folks pushing for more atomic weapons, but public opinion was so strongly against it. It's a curious little story that in August of 1953, the Russians exploded a highly sophisticated hydrogen bomb. Now, we knew that they had a weapons program, but Eisenhower was terrifically worried because this was such a sophisticated weapon. And he actually considered having a kind of fireside chat, which I characterize as maybe a mushroom cloud chat, with the American people in 1953 to explain to us that this is a terrible risk to the survival of humans on Earth. You know, he was deeply shaken by this. But by December of that year, 1953, He was before the General Assembly at the United Nations in New York, giving his Atoms for Peace speech. And in that, he is trying to promise this untold benefit. We'll solve world hunger. It's going to improve medicine. It's just going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. And that was his sales pitch to repackage the horror of atomic weapons and instead sell this other product, which is untold benefit for peaceful mankind.
Even the title Atoms for Peace was a rebranding of nuclear, even when we weren't using that particular technology. And it was based on having nuclear reactors provide power. And the phrase they used was that the power produced would be, quote unquote, too cheap to meter. They're always saying that it's going to be financially viable and, as you said, a benefit. Where did Atoms for Peace go wrong? Or was it wrong from the beginning?
You mentioned the quip by Louis Strauss, who was head of the Atomic Energy Commission, that nuclear power would give us energy, quote, too cheap to meter. He had in his possession at the time he made that public statement a government-sponsored report on the feasibility of nuclear power. It identified the biggest problem with nuclear power as being cost. So I would suggest that that very statement of too cheap to meter was a bald-faced lie from the get-go. And it's my argument that what the government has done is has given us all these sales pitches. It's too cheap to meter. It's clean. It can solve climate change. None of those arguments are at all true. They're just meant to sound good to the public and to gain public acceptance and support for the nuclear enterprise.
One of the problems that you point out repeatedly in the article and that is well known is that in the waste stream from a nuclear reactor, those quote unquote spent fuel rods aren't really spent at all because they contain plutonium. And the plutonium, with just a few steps, can be made weapons grade. So in essence, any country that has a nuclear reactor has the potential for creating a nuclear weapon. And indeed, that is how both India and Pakistan got their nuclear weapons.
They had Canadian CANDU reactors.
They got theirs from Canada, but it was the same concept of we're sharing the technology because this is a good thing for you.
Sharing the peaceful technology. Now, the fact is that the vast majority of all the vast inputs needed for nuclear weapons, what's needed for nuclear power is just about the same thing as nuclear weapons. Obviously, designing a weapon is different than just operating a reactor, but it maintains the same infrastructure, vast infrastructure. The Manhattan Project, which was developed in secret in 1942, constructed an industrial base in this country that was the same size as the automobile industry was at that time. And I think we all have an understanding when we get in a car and you start thinking, well, what does it take to make a car? Well, you've got the sheet metal, you've got the glass, you have all different kinds of glass, you have the radio knobs and the door knobs and the steering, you know, just so many parts and inputs and special materials. And the nuclear enterprise is the same way. It's a vast, broad, industrial, academic, military, and governmental infrastructure. And by pushing Atoms for Peace, we help develop that infrastructure in this country in the early 50s.
And of course, with the infrastructure that was developed in the 1940s to actually build the first bombs, we had so much of it in Oak Ridge, at Hanford in Washington State, and at Los Alamos that the government did not want to back away from that and say, okay, we're going to make all this garbage now. They went, what can we do with it? And it's been brought to my awareness that one of the drivers behind the push for Atoms for Peace was the ability of the government, which until then was tasked with coming up with its own plutonium and having reactors to create it and all of the expense with that, was able to fob off the reactors to create plutonium on private enterprise, on private investment. And that allowed them to alleviate that particular cost.
The creation of the civilian nuclear power industry in the early 1950s served several ends. Number one, it essentially spun off this very large, essential part of the weapons industry and again repackaged it as peaceful civilian industry. Now, I am not saying that they're making nuclear weapons at your local nuclear reactor, but I am saying that the infrastructure needed for nuclear reactor power generation supports and builds the infrastructure needed for making nuclear weapons. Part of this, too, was, if you recall, the Manhattan Project was entirely a governmental organization. And there are some in our political spectrum who feel that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was almost a socialist. Certainly, it was too much government influence. So not only were they spinning off this huge part of the weapons endeavor, they were giving it to capitalism, private enterprise. And so this was to counterbalance what had been such a governmentally oriented effort previously. But it has never had to be self-supporting. It's not cheap. It doesn't make money. You mentioned the Price-Anderson Act. If it's so safe, why aren't there commercial insurers scrambling to insure it? Well, it's because it's not so safe. It's too big a risk.
Insurance companies will not touch it on any level, either to insure the facilities themselves or to insure homeowners for any damage that is done because of a radiation release or a nuclear anything. And I challenge anyone who's a homeowner who is listening to this discussion to go to their homeowner's insurance policy and look under exclusions, and they will see that there is always, always in the boilerplate, a specific exclusion for being able to make claims for any damage that happens because of a nuclear incident.
Yes. So you look at the nuclear industry, you have government loan guarantees, which basically say, if you borrow money to build a reactor and it doesn't work out, we will cover the shortfall. Then you have the government paying for the operating liability insurance, which for such a dangerous endeavor is a huge cost. And then the government's taking the waste at the end of it. I mean, what other industry, I ask you, has this special treatment? And you'd think that with all those benefits, they'd be making money hand over fist, which many of the companies are. But there still is ongoing massive subsidies for nuclear operations. And my argument is that that's all justified because the real purpose is the weapons and the nuclear navy. It's not cheap power. It's not clean power. It's not solving climate change. Now, that's what it's sold to us as, but that's not what's driving the bus here.
You made a comment on a conference call that we were all on with Radiation and Public Health, Joe Mangano's group. And that was what got my ears pricked up to talk with you here, because you were saying that in terms of activists and the argument against nuclear for climate change, that argument has been made repeatedly and well, but nobody's paying attention to it. So it's like we're hitting a bullseye, but we're aiming at the wrong target. Explain that.
Yes, I'd say there's a sham target. The real target is nuclear weapons and the nuclear navy. But I want to be very clear for your listeners that the critiques of nuclear power, be it on the basis of cost, environmental degradation, safety, and the totally unsolved and huge problem of nuclear waste and pollution, those are all valid, important, critical arguments. What got me started on this whole line of thinking was I read one more wonderfully done, thoroughly researched, expertly presented argument against nuclear power, and I observed that that's not changing the trajectory of the enterprise. We're absolutely right. I mean, in 2006, Bryce Smith wrote a book called Insurmountable Risks, in which he basically said, how can nuclear power solve climate change? Let's just for the argument's sake, remove all these pesky environmentalists and anti-nuke folks. Let's just tell the industry, go solve climate change with nuclear power. And it's impossible for them to do it, even without any impediments. They'd have to be opening up a new reactor every week and a new geological waste repository every year. We can't even do that over decades. And the new reactors being built are, as has always been the case, terrifically behind schedule and way over budget.
I'd like to jump in on that because I recently read a rundown of the new nuclear reactors that said that at this time, the small modular, and they call them SMR, small modular reactors. They take the N word out, nuclear. I call them small modular nuclear reactors. The number that are currently being built, zero. The number of designs approved, zero. The fact that the only place they can get the special fuel that they need, which is this high-powered fuel, it's called HALEU, it's high-assay, low-enrichment uranium. The only place that it is manufactured is in Russia.
Correct.
And that might be at least one of the factors underlying why there are no sanctions against anything in the nuclear industry as regards Russia since the war on Ukraine.
Yes. What I could say about small modular nuclear reactors is that their true purpose, as noted in the 2018 World Nuclear Industry Status Report, their real purpose is for submarine and naval propulsion units. They're not for Topeka, Kansas. But there's been a massive program. Every town and village is talking about, well, gosh, we might have an SMR here. Well, I don't think they will appear, and you're totally right. They're what we call PowerPoint reactors. They exist only on paper, but their purpose is the nuclear Navy. You mentioned HALEU fuel, high assay, low enriched uranium fuel. High enrichment is considered to be 20% U-235. HALEU fuel is enriched to 19.8%. So it's right up to the cutoff point. And to get from the 0.7% enrichment of natural ore to 19.8% enrichment is the lion's share of the work to getting to weapons grade. So again, the HALEU fuel, I am arguing its true purpose. It's not for the SMR down the road. It's for weapons production. And you also are very correct that there's a big push in the United States government to create the entire uranium fuel chain within our country. And HALEU fuel will be part of this. Senator Manchin just introduced a bill, 4064, the International Nuclear Energy Act of 2022. This bill would create a whole-of-government enterprise to promote United States exports of nuclear energy infrastructure to countries around the world.
And this goes to a point that has been coming clear to me about how the proliferation and the promotion of nuclear reactors and nuclear technology on the ground is really a Cold War expansion and a gathering together of allies, not necessarily willing allies, but ultimate and forever allies. Because once you're tied in with the nuclear infrastructure of a country, be it the United States or Russia, once you are tied in, you cannot separate yourself. It's like for a reactor, parts are not interchangeable between different systems. There's no such thing as an auto zone for nuclear. There's no nuclear zone. You have materials and parts that cannot be swapped out with each other. So once you have gotten in bed with whoever your supplier is, that's where you're stuck. And it's forever because they're in charge of the parts, the technology, the training of the people who are responsible for the infrastructure. And then you've got the problem of the waste, which nobody has solved yet, except dumping it around indigenous people or third world people or someplace where the white male majority is not. So the proliferation and the promotion of this technology by these different countries is really an ultimate Cold War leading to a kind of nuclear slavery, that any country that gets in bed with one of the big powers saying, oh, we'll give you nukes, it might be attractive on the front end, but on the back end, there's no out. You will never get out of it.
Yes, and this is a strategy of a kind of technological domination as a military strategy. The F-35 fighter plane illustrates this very much. Its supply chain within this country is in 48 of the 50 states. And we are selling it to 12 of our allies, and we're manufacturing parts of it in many other foreign countries. You know, Germany just last week decided to buy this F-35, which technologically speaking has been a very flawed product. But it's the big deal in air forces. And once you buy it, yes, you are bound to the United States.
So turning this to an activist perspective, you said quite pointedly that we've hit the bullseye, but we're aiming at the wrong target. That's a great way to put it. What would you suggest we make our target? And how would you suggest that we start prioritizing our arguments and working on our talking points?
Well, I think that what we need to do, there's characteristically been a bifurcation of the nuclear movement and nuclear attitudes. People say, oh, I work on nuclear power. Oh, I work on nuclear weapons. And I think we have to blend those two groups together, and both groups work on both aspects. And again, I repeat that the arguments against nuclear power are cogent, they're important, and they're real. And so I think that what we need to do is expand our horizon. So we're really saying we need to move away from nuclear weapons and nuclear navies. And one of the reasons is because of the cost. And then you can point to all the costs of reactors, or it's the environmental degradation. You can point to, you know, every step of the fuel chain, from the mining of uranium to milling and enrichment and fuel fabrication, to the regular releases from nuclear power reactors. You know, all these things are very important items, but I think we need to put it in the context of what it's really supporting, which is the nuclear weapons and the nuclear navy.
Is that a project that has come before Physicians for Social Responsibility that you know? Do you know of any groups that are specifically working on coordinating our talking points so that we focus on that and perhaps become more effective in our messaging?
I do not know of any groups currently who are trying to take this approach of taking this perspective that I argue in my piece in The Progressive that says it's all about the bomb. And so this discussion is just starting. I'm hoping that the publication of my article, I'm hoping this podcast will spur people to have further discussion. I would love to discuss this with other people to develop strategies, but it's kind of in the formative stages of this. But I got started on this, Libby, because I read yet one more expert article critiquing nuclear power, but it doesn't do anything. And so that's why I think we need to have our target be what the real driving force of this nuclear enterprise.
Well, I have to say that if you're dealing with languaging or messaging, count me in on that discussion and that strategizing. I will be open to anyone who contacts me to put them in contact with you and see what we might do to get a group together, at least a Zoom call, sometime early in 2023. And I invite you to come back on the show as this progresses and give us updates as to what our messaging can be and how we can be more effective in the steps we take and the energy we exert in trying to put an end to nuclear weapons and nuclear energy.
Yes, and if I could add on a comment about the fusion experiment, which a couple of weeks ago was successful. And again, I mean, because this illustrates the argument I'm making. I'm sure that your listeners saw articles about, you know, we're going to have clean power that doesn't even make nuclear waste now. Well, no, we won't. The real purpose of that experiment was to confirm the validity of the computer programs used to design nuclear weapons, because we no longer test nuclear weapons in the real world. So it's all based on computer programs. And that experiment was a critical part of proving that those computer programs are correct. But so that's for weapons. But you didn't see any news coverage about, well, maybe we'll develop a fusion weapon. And this is why it would be such a good battlefield tool. No, you heard this pablum, this false narrative about, well, we're going to have clean power now. I don't think it'll happen in the lifetime of my grandchildren. Of course, I hope that all of us can change the trajectory of the nuclear enterprise well before that.
Alfred, listening to you first on the conference call with Radiation and Public Health Project opened my ears. You have now progressively, between the article and this conversation, continued to open my eyes, and I will do my best to carry that message forward on Nuclear Hot Seat.
I just welcome your involvement and that of others. This needs to be a collaborative and networking effort. There are many good groups like Back from the Brink, which work to end the nuclear weapons threat. But I think we need to get them on board to say that, in my mind, if we are going after both the weapons and the reactors which enable them, we stand a good chance of success. And as I note in my article, civilian nuclear power, and this is a quote from ex-U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, he said that civilian nuclear power is an essential enabler of our national security, which I define as nuclear weapons, the nuclear navy, and the very downtown think tank in Washington, D.C., the Atlantic Council. It has calculated this contribution of civilian nuclear power to our national security at $42.4 billion per year. So this, again, is how, by spinning off civilian nuclear power, we don't have to ask for that much money for the weapons program, because it's not weapons, right? Well, correct, they're not making weapons at the reactor sites, but if we didn't have them, it wouldn't be, we wouldn't have the nuclear weapons capacity. For every reactor, power reactor we have on land in the U.S., which is about 100, there are almost 100 naval reactors at sea. So it's by having a big civilian nuclear power effort, we are enabling the nuclear weapons side of things. And a big challenge for the industry, too, is attracting bright young science students into this field. And I think that's one reason why SMRs are so highly touted and presented as they're coming to every neighborhood near you, because that gives people the idea that, well, this is a cutting edge industry. I think I better get on with it, as opposed to the more accurate viewpoint, again pointed out by the World Nuclear Industry Status Report, that the nuclear power industry has been in decline since the year 2002. For the past 20 years, this industry has been contracting. And that's a huge challenge for the industry. And this is why they need such a deceptive sales pitch that makes us think that this is going to be great for all of us.
So the work of those who oppose nuclear is about taking that vulnerability and turning it into our talking points and making that where we push, so that we're putting the crowbar under the right piece of information and getting that out into the world. And we need to do that in a coordinated way, in an echo chamber kind of a way. The nuclear industry has its own, because my God, when that fusion announcement happened, it wasn't some little press release. They had this pre-planned across the board. I don't remember ever seeing such a blatant full court press, everything from government and press conference and TV news, all the way through Dan Rather and Stephen Colbert doing 7 minutes of it on his show. And then they back away from it because the point's been made, the thought has been surgically implanted in people's minds, and nuclear industry doesn't have to do anything else because we're swimming upstream to try and get that taken out. They've already implanted it. So there are lots of challenges for those of us who wish to support accurate messaging about nuclear and its dangers and where it's connected and why we need to get rid of it in a way that people can understand.
And I think another thing from a strategy standpoint to consider is that to possess the nuclear enterprise, to possess nuclear weapons, for instance, in the best case scenario, even if there are no accidents, no problems, you know, if everything went perfectly, it still harms the population that possesses the weapons, that we are contaminating our biosphere. You know, even if we don't and never use one of these weapons, just to have them in our arsenal is very damaging to us. And we, in fact, as a world, are involved in a unplanned, out of control, non-consensual human experiment of irradiating the biosphere. And we know not what this will do. And there's, you know, discussion of Japan dumping all this, they call it tritiated water, back into the ocean. But the report discussion I just heard recently is that, in fact, they don't know what's in those tanks. Yes, there's tritium, but there are about 60 other things there too, and they have not characterized what it is. They don't know how much. So how in the world can they say, oh, it's safe to do? They don't know what they're doing. But from a business standpoint, sure, a lot better to dump it in the sea than to pay for taking care of it. So we're up against a huge military industrial forces. But I always maintain the only reason you and I are able to have this conversation today is that there are more good people than bad, and we need to rally together and succeed in this effort.
I couldn't have put it better. Alfred Meyer, this has been a greatly illuminating conversation. I look forward to having many more with you in 2023 and beyond. And I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you.
That was Alfred Meyer, longtime Physicians for Social Responsibility member and leader. We'll have a link up to his article from The Progressive. It's all about the bomb, why civilian nuclear power is merely a cover for producing more nuclear weapons. It will be on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 605. And while you're at the website, look for the yellow opt-in box. And if you haven't already, sign up to get one email a week from Nuclear Hot Seat with a link to this week's episode and a brief summary of some other material from the show.
Activists, shout out.
Celebrations took place around the world on January 22nd to commemorate the second anniversary of the Treaty to Prohibit Nuclear Weapons entering into legal force. One particularly powerful demonstration took place in North Carolina, put together by North Carolina Peace Action, when a replica of a nuclear bomb was brought to the Terry Sanford Federal Building in Raleigh to commemorate the anniversary of the catastrophic 1961 B-52 nuclear bomber accident near Goldsboro. Around midnight on January 24, 1961, a B-52 bomber crashed and dropped its two 3.8 megaton nuclear bombs onto a farm in Faro, North Carolina. Although one bomb was recovered, parts of the nuclear core of the other bomb remain buried at the site. This is only one of at least 76 nuclear accidents, known as broken arrows, that we know about, with at least six nuclear weapons that were never recovered. Peace Action Representative Joe Cicero pointed out, "Peace Action's success comes from our nationwide grassroots network made up of ordinary citizens. We keep a report card on members of Congress on how they vote on nuclear weapons issues. If one submarine launched its nuclear weapons, the smoke from burning cities would block the sunlight for 5 to 10 years, causing what is known as nuclear winter, killing crops and, by extension, the human race." In Washington State, Hanford Challenge has launched a nuclear waste-themed poetry contest. It's open to any student attending college or university in Washington State, and cash prizes will be provided. We will post a link up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 605. And John LaForge of Nuke Watch, who is currently serving a 50-day prison sentence in Germany because of two protests that he staged against the Buchel Air Base in Germany, where the U.S. has as many as 20 nuclear weapons stockpiled, was let out of prison for 10 hours last Sunday so he could participate in celebrations of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons being passed into law 2 years ago. While there, he ran into Linda Pence Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, who is also the author of our regular feature, Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story. And there's a great picture of the two of them. Also, we're going to be having exciting news about John LaForge in connection with Nuclear Hot Seat, but we can't put that out into the world until after he is released on March 1st. Something to look forward to. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, January 24, 2023. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, beyondnuclear.org, NIRS.org, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICANW.org, thebulletin.org, North Carolina Peace Action, Hanford Challenge, MSN.com, Yahoo.com, HCN.org, BBC.com, TheGuardian.com, CRI.CN, Reuters.com, Stuff.co.nz, RNZ.co.nz, ChinaDaily.com, Tokyo-NP.co.jp, English.news.cn, Eon.co, Greenpeace, Kim Roberson, Counterpunch.org, KyotoNews.net, NHK.or.jp, and of course, the captured and compromised by the industry they are supposed to be regulating, Nuclear Regulatory Commission. If you would like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's easy. And this way, you never miss out on a single episode. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down for the yellow opt-in box, put in your first name, put in an alias, I don't care, but make it a good email address. And every week, automatically, you will get one email with a link to each week's show and a short description of the contents. Or if you listen to podcasts a lot, sign up on your favorite podcast platform. We're there, too. The goal is for this show to be everywhere. Now, come on, help me out. If you've got a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Please, not Facebook. I lose those. Send it to the email. I always get them. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help, and anything you can do, we appreciate, deeply appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2023, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of the guests whose comments you use, and, if you get around to it, me. This is Libby Halevi, producer and host of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, we must remind Japan that if the radioactive nuclear wastewater is safe, just dump it in Tokyo, test it in Paris, and store it in Washington. But keep our Pacific nuclear free. That's from the nation of Vanuatu's celebrated former Turaga chief, Motorilavoa Hilda Lini. So there it is, this week's nuclear wake-up call just for you. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the Nuclear Hot Seat.
Nuclear Hot Seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear Hot Seat. It's da bomb.